Away from your radio, listen to Cambridge 105 online through your computer or smartphone. Go to cambridge105.fm and click Listen Now.
It's 12 o'clock on Saturday, the 23rd of February, and you are listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 with me, Matt Bentman, Ruth Reyes, fresh from her trip to Amsterdam, and Alan Alder.
And on the programme today, we have the first in our series of On the Menu, which features an interview with Rosie Sykes, Guardian food writer, cookbook writer, and head chef at Fitzbillies.
And we find out about the new supper club on the Cambridge scene. It's called the First Rule Supper Club. We have news of the Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. Quite a number of events have sold out already, so we'll try and give you some idea of what's still available.
And we'll be finding out about Gluten Tutten, which provides foods for more than 1 in 100 of us who have a gluten intolerance. In addition, we'll be visiting the Rocker's Steakhouse on Mill Road. Tom Lewis returns with more information about sherry. I get clueless in the kitchen. And we'll also be having our look at the food and drink ideas from today's papers. So let's begin.
As we have reported upon before, the high rents in Cambridge can be a deterrent to new businesses. That affects restaurants as much as anyone, and it can mean that that we don't get the same opportunities to try new and even experimental places to eat. One way around this, which is beginning to show signs of taking off in Cambridge, is pop-up restaurants. The Steak and Honour pop-up at Fitzbillies recently virtually sold out within 24 hours of being announced. Another opportunity is supper clubs. There are several in Cambridge already, but new on the scene is the First Rule Supper Club. Alan spoke to co-founder Adam Byrne about it a couple of days ago.
Our first event is on the 5th of April. That's a Friday, and we start at 7 p.m.
Secret location?
Of course, yeah. We like to remain as mysterious as possible. So anybody who books will be revealing the location maybe a week before. But suffice to say, it's very near central Cambridge, so no one will have any problems getting there.
Right. What do you want the evenings to be like?
Our strapline is the ultimate dine-in but out social mixer. So the idea being it's very intimate, good home-cooked food, but restaurant quality, good wine pairings, but most of all, great company, and also maybe a bit of entertainment in there, so we might be doing some stuff along those lines.
All right, this sounds intriguing.
Yeah, it's nothing as bad as come dine with me, don't worry. That's pretty cringeworthy.
And what sort of number of people do you think you'll be catering for? What's your ideal figure, I suppose?
Yeah, so I think for this first event, because it's our debut, we're limiting it to about 20. We can probably go over that a tiny bit, but so getting there quick, really.
Right, so you're sort of testing it out, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And what sort of food are you going to be doing? I mean, obviously, one event's going to be different from another, but will there be any sort of commonality, do you think?
Yeah, so I think for this first event, we're running with a very French traditional theme. So Pascal, who's my business partner, is effectively, well, she grew up in Africa. She's French and the other half of her family. So she has this great tradition of French patisserie, French cooking, grew up on a vineyard, so knows a lot about wine, very well connected with all those people. So
so there's going to be a French influence in the...
Absolutely, in the cooking and in the preparation, everything. So that's our shtick for the first event.
And I guess you have to do a lot of preparation for these things. I mean, I guess you don't just go along to a supermarket and buy the produce. What have you been doing?
Yeah, so probably more preparation than we'd anticipated, in fact. So firstly, I think, we call ourselves the first rule. One of our rules is we really don't want to go along to supermarkets. We want to use local providers, and we want to know where our food is sourced, and we want to be able to know the quality, not least in light of the recent horse meat scandals and all that kind of stuff. So we want to play to that. But beyond that, of course, there's the food, there's doing trial recipes. So Pascal and I are busy kind of preparing things, tasting them. There's, finding tables big enough. There's buying nice linen, lots of cutlery, crockery, wine, we're sourcing all sorts of things. So, it's a very, very busy time, and a lot more effort is going into this than I think either of us realised would.
Right. Well, I've seen some of the photographs on the Facebook page, And the food does look really good, actually. But the quality of the photographs is very impressive as well. Who's the photographer?
So that's Pascal. We both are quite artistic people. So despite having a very scientific day job, I like to be arty outside of that. So we're both musicians. We do a bit of photography and we do a lot of cooking and we love food. So this is how we met and how we kind of how we gel, because we share all of these passions. Yeah. And we found a way in the First Rule Supper Club to bring all of this stuff together and mostly bring it to other people, because there's nothing we like more than to see people, you know, enjoying the fruits of our labours.
And you've mentioned wine pairings. Mm. So you are going to be, what, providing wine as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So the plan is we're doing a four-course meal and we're providing a certain amount of wine. Now, people are very welcome to bring their own as well, but we feel it's actually quite important to pair a decent wine with the food in advance, so you kind of get those flavour combinations right.
I couldn't agree more. That's one of the great pleasures in life, is getting those two things in balance, isn't it?
Precisely. So we're off doing some wine tastings at the moment and finding out what we're going to serve with some of our delicious food.
So it's not without its pleasures, then?
Oh, no. Yeah, it's a hard job, but someone's got to do it.
But when people, if you're giving people the opportunity to take their own wine as well, they're going to need to know about what they're going to eat in order to be able to, you know, make their selection as they'd like it to be. So are you going to be revealing what people are going to be getting?
Yeah, so we're not going to be so secretive about that. I think, you know, we're leaking things via our Twitter feed, which you're very welcome to join. And slowly but surely, as people get closer to the event, I think they'll start to realise the kind of things we're going for.
Right, so the first evening's coming up. What's the cost going to be?
So the cost is a mere £35 per head. So that's going to include four courses and the wine and coffee. So we're pricing it quite keenly for the first time, because
we want
to encourage people to give us a go, because I think that when they've seen what we can do, they'll be coming back and coming back.
And the are you doing coffee tastings as well?
Well, again, Pascal being French, she has a very keen taste for coffee and has some favourites that I think she wants to introduce the world to. So
fascinating. Yeah. Right. Okay, so you're doing this for the first time and discovering that it's more than you expected it to be in terms of work. So have you got any feel for what the frequency of them is going to be?
Ideally, the plan was to run one every month. I think we're going to tentatively see how this first one goes, but it will at least be every other month. So, but the plan is 1 month, and we'll see how this one goes.
Yeah, well, good luck with it. It sounds really enticing. How do people book?
So we've got a website, which is www.thefirstrule.co.uk. So that's all one word. And you can book online there with a credit card. Or alternatively, if you want to reserve a space, just email us at events@thefirstrule.co.uk.
And that was Adam Byrne from the First Rule Supper Club. And a reminder that you can follow them on Facebook and Twitter at First Rule Supper. You can book at www.thefirstrule.co.uk.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Coming up, On the Menu with Rosie Sykes from Fitzbillies, Tom Lewis on Sherry, Clueless in the Kitchen, and our review of the best food and drink ideas in today's papers.
And a reminder that you can keep up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105. That's where you'll read about the news that we discover ourselves. And we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources at Flavour105 for frequent updates of food and drink in Cambridge. Now, there's a new venue in town, and it's rock and roll as we know it. Today I sit at a table in a new Cambridge restaurant, a restaurant where it wouldn't look out of place to see John Travolta and Uma Thurman sitting at the next bay, where gold discs, Stratocasters and Les Pauls provide the decoration. This is the Rocker's Steakhouse on Mill Road, the Petersfield side of Mill Road, I should add, and I'm sitting here with George, one of the proprietors. George, welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Hi Matt, it's nice to meet you.
You'll have to forgive me on this. When I first saw the Rocker's Steakhouse on Mill Road late last year, you opened up in October, yes, was it?
Yeah, we opened up officially on the October the 15th, so we've been open now for about 5 months.
What made you pick out Cambridge to set up shop, or perhaps what made you pick out Mill Road?
Well, I've been in the Cambridge area now for over 18 years. I actually studied here at Anglia Ruskin University, so I really do love the city. You can meet people from all four corners of the earth, and it's really good because you can make friends from everywhere, and it makes it more exciting to set up business here than anywhere else for me.
Now, there's three of you as the proprietors of the Rocker's Steakhouse. How does it work? Is like one of you the muscle, one's the money, one's the chef?
Well, I actually come from a cocktail background. My partners come from the food restaurant industry. My expertise was to create and craft the cocktail side of things, of the menu, and also the spirits and the wines. And their expertise was to deliver the food, the quality of the meat, some of the flavouring and seasoning that we put on as well. For example, the lamb chops are seasoned with cumin, coriander, and got a bit of a hint of spice with them.
Yeah.
My partner, who's the chef, that was one of his contributions, and that's one of our major sellers at the moment, is the lamb chops.
Now, Rocker's is a steakhouse. There's a lot of charbroil cooking going on. The charbroiling cooks the meat at speed, but it also maintains this tenderness by not drying out the meat. And one of the keys to your distinctive charbroiling here is the Josper. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about what's so special about a Josper?
The Josper is a professional grill oven that burns premium charcoals. It's actually invented in Spain, and it's starting to get really big now in the last 15 years. Essentially, a Josper grill is an oven and a charcoal grill rolled into one. So instead of grilling your steaks before finishing off in the oven, the Josper turns the two-step process into one.
Yeah.
The result is that you get steaks that are cooked in half the time it usually takes to grill your steaks on an open grill. I guess you could describe it as a cross between an indoor barbecue and an aga. And I also sometimes refer to it as a barbecue in a box. It has a really thick door that prevents any of the moisture getting out of the Josper. The high intense heat seals the moisture and the water into the meat, so you end up with really juicy tasting meat, and you've got the flavour of the charcoal as well.
I didn't know that you could have different grades of charcoal, but you can tell the difference, yes, between meat cooked using this oven to, say, non-Jospered meat. I read a description somewhere about it cooking the meat until it just melts.
Yeah, the Josper gives a unique flavour. The charcoals that we use are high-grade charcoal supplied by Josper themselves. You end up with steaks that are very juicy because of the fact that it seals in the moisture to the meat, plus also the flavour of the charcoal. Combine that together and you get a very, very unique flavour indeed.
I understand a lot of high-profile restaurants have a Josper, including Heston Blumenthal's in Knightsbridge. It's, I was going to say it's very fashionable, but that's underselling it. This is a really, really useful piece of kit in that it produces fast and at volume, yes?
Yeah, the Josper can actually reach temperatures of around 500 degrees Celsius, which is very, very hot indeed. So the best thing about it is that you can really knock out great tasting food at half the time it usually takes when you're cooking food in barbecue style. Whereas usually it may take 5 minutes to cook a medium rare steak in a Josper, you can cut that down to about 2.5 minutes, maybe 3 minutes. So you really can get the product to the customer much quicker and more efficiently.
This is vital. I mean, it may sound like we're talking a lot about the Josper, but it really is the heart of the operation, isn't it? It wouldn't work like this without the Josper.
No, it is indeed. When we first tried food from the Josper, we decided straight away that we wanted to build the restaurant and the menu around the Josper, which is how the natural course of events has occurred. One of the things about Josper is it is very unique. There aren't many of them around. They're very expensive pieces of equipment. You're talking around £15,000 to £20,000, depending on what model you go for. But we felt that the food and the taste that you could acquire from the Josper simply couldn't be beaten. So we decided to go with the Josper and build up a menu around it.
Do you ever receive any feedback from customers about the taste of the burgers? Do they recognise you as very distinctive flavour?
Certainly, the customers do pick up on the flavours. They can tell that the food's been barbecued, but what puzzles them is that there's no dryness, because usually when you barbecue meat, there is an element where you dry the food out. One of the things that customers do notice is that the meat, especially chicken, fish, steaks, is really, really juicy, and that's something that you can't get with a barbecue flavour any other way.
Now, these Jospers, they kick out a pretty fierce heat, don't they? And does a new cook who comes to work at Rocker's have to adapt himself to working with a Josper as opposed to your more conventional oven?
Absolutely. The chef can't take his eyes off the Josper, because when you're dealing with heat as intense as 500 degrees Celsius, if you take your eyes off for 10 seconds, that could be the difference between a medium well or a medium rare. So this is something that the chef really has to pay attention to. If you don't pay attention, you just end up cremating the food because of the heat that you're dealing with.
And the Josper is only part of the equation, of course, so also important is the quality of and where you source your meat from. And this is where Andrew Northrup comes in.
Well, yeah, we decided we wanted to use the local butchers because they could give us the personal touch. I like to work with local businesses as well, independents like us.
Yeah.
So I like to support those rather than the big chains. We feel that they give us much more attention than the bigger chains would. So whenever we have a problem, they instantly deal with it. And we found them very, very good to deal with. And the quality of the meat is excellent. We use Aberdeen Angus steaks, which they provide. And we found that using them has really improved the quality of the steaks that we're selling.
Let's talk about the Rocker's menu now, because you serve a variety of burgers, all differentiated by their toppings. My eyes were drawn instantly to the Big Blue, and this contains blue cheese and a creamy chipotle sauce, and chipotle is like a smoke-dried jalapeno chili, which seems a rather odd thing to combine with blue cheese, but I would try it anyway, because I just adore blue cheese on burgers. I can't get enough. But yeah, are there other things you've got going on here?
Yeah, one of the things that we'd like to do is to introduce a burger challenge. So for those viewers who have familiar with Man vs. Food, which is big in America, eating challenges, we want to introduce something like that here. So we were thinking about an ultimate burger challenge, which would have around 24 to 32 ounces of meat, which is quite a lot, chips and sides, and we'll give the contender, I'll say, half an hour to finish that. So that's one of the things we're toying with. We're at the process now of developing that, so that should be coming out soon. So keep your eyes peeled for that one.
And as well as the Rocker's Steakhouse, you serve various styles of steak, chicken and fish. And I guess the Josper is also good for, say, roasted veg too, like maybe oven-roasted tomatoes and courgettes, or even things like seafood, potatoes or toast.
Well, it's interesting that you've said that, Matt, because a lot of people come over and they assume that being a steakhouse, that we don't do a vegetarian option and that we don't really pay much attention to that side of things. But the thing about the Josper is, because it's such a unique flavour, that doesn't just apply to the meats, that also applies to the vegetables that you put inside.
Yeah.
So if I could use mushrooms as an example, when I first tried mushrooms from the Josper, I was blown away because they act as flavour sponges. So you get a lot of really juicy mushrooms, but you really do get the flavour of the charcoal from them as well. The same goes for peppers, onions, courgettes, anything like that. When you put it into the Josper, it sears all of the flavour of the charcoal and also the natural moisture of the vegetables inside.
Mm-hmm. And how has life at the Rocker's been since you've opened? Has everything been going well so far?
Well, we have invested significant amounts of time and energy into Rocker's, and it's always great to see when people are happy with us, because what we want is to offer something completely different, an eating experience that people can't get anywhere else, because it is a rock theme after all. There isn't anywhere in Cambridge where you can hear The Who, Bon Jovi, AC/DC when you're having your food. This is quite unusual. But what I've noticed that most places tend to offer background music, it's kind of, you know, the same sort of music that they all play. What we wanted to do was inject some rock and roll into that,
yeah,
so that people could have an eating experience.
And perhaps worth mentioning too, you also do this very good lunchtime deal, don't you? Burger, fries and drink for, say, £5 or £6. Same price as a fast food place, yet 10 times more flavour.
Yeah, that's right, Matt. We actually do a starting burger, which is the classic hamburger, with chips and a drink for £5. It's actually £4.95, so it's unbelievable value. There are many students around, and we understand that people are on a budget, so we still wanted to attract those people. The value is great. You cannot get flavours and tastes like that, burgers like that, anywhere else for that price in Cambridge.
Well, thanks very much, George, for this interview. Once again, I am here at the Rocker's Steakhouse on Mill Road. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Matt. Nice to meet you.
With a 5-star food hygiene rating from the council, a left-handed guitar in the logo, and my heroes emblazoned on every wall, be sure to check out the Rockers on Mill Road, close to Parker's Peace.
And now a new feature. We find out what's on the menu in some of Cambridge's most interesting restaurants. And a restaurant whose recent menus, they change every week, include starters like duck hearts, monk's beard on toast, and mains like game faggot, clapshot, and onion gravy, deserves to be on our first visit. The interest of balance, I should point out that there are more conventional dishes available. The restaurant is Tim Hayward and Alison Wright's Fitzbillies, and the head chef is Rosie Sykes.
Rosie, the menu at Fitzbillies is really quite distinctive, and distinctive is going to be a word I'm going to try to avoid overusing, but one of the distinctive features is that it changes, I think, totally every week. And some chefs are quite reluctant to do that, but you obviously do it wholeheartedly.
Well, yes.
Why is that?
I think it's really important to change it every week, just because it means it's a challenge for the whole team. It's something different. It's something interesting. I always worry about menus that don't change a lot, because I feel that the staff in the kitchen can get very used to things, and perhaps that's when they're not, don't sparkle as much as they should. I think, you know, there are often dishes which are real favourites, which will stay on a menu, and that's absolutely fine. But I think it's really important to mix it up. And for me, it's all about housekeeping as well. So I try and find out what's really good. If a supplier rings with something that is really different or really good value or only around for a couple of weeks, then I'll always make sure I include that on my menu. So I spend a lot of time talking to people. And also I'm in a very fortunate position that I have, I get vegetables from Audley End House, from the garden there, via Cambridge Organic Food Company. And I never know what I'm going to get from them until it appears. So it's a bit of a lottery, but I just think it's a really nice way to write a menu. Yeah.
It maintains interest, I guess, and keeps people on their mettle. A lot more work, presumably. You have to think of things every week and react to people every week.
Yes, absolutely. You do. And sometimes that can be a real challenge. And Thursdays, the day we get everything ready for dinner, can be an absolute bun fight. And sometimes I'm not sure how things are going to turn out. But I think that's part of the joy of it, really.
So you don't get people coming back wanting what they've had previously or feeling a bit disappointed or
no,
does that happen?
No, I don't think so. For example, we always try in the winter months to have a pie on or a braise. So there'll always be something hearty. So I think, you know, although the menu changes, it has a lot of common thread. So I think actually I hope people find it as exciting as we do to cook, that it changes so often. And we do have regulars. We have one lady who comes every week and she's delighted.
Yes, well, to be honest, I'm not surprised by that. You know, you can see that it's the Fitzbillies menu. I think that's what I'm trying to say. So the fact that you have followers, I don't think is surprising. But some things on the menus, I guess, are possibly challenging to some people in the sense of knowing what they are. Monk's beard, for example. Not everybody knows what monk's beard is.
No.
You know, is it a fish? Is it a cut of meat?
In fact, sometimes there's one thing that I've put on a few times, which is called silk weaver's brain. And when we put the menu in the window, we would normally edit that to be called a cream cheese, soft cheese, fresh cheese with herbs, because actually to see that in a window, some people would be quite afeared by that or confused. So there are a few things that we'll kind of juggle with, but apart from that, I have a long conversation with the floor staff about what we go through the menu for about 20 minutes and I tell them what everything is, so nobody is unsure before they talk to customers. And it's just a case of, I think it's really important to interact with the customers and explain things to them. So hopefully it works that way.
Yes, well, I mean, I have heard people asking what, in fact, I did ask myself once what something was. So yes, there is that dialogue that goes on, which is all part of the fun, really, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. What's on this week's menu then, or tonight's menu?
Well, one of my standouts is I've got crispy pig's ears on, which they come out looking a little bit like a Chinese dish, which is salt and pepper squid. So they're little kind of circles of crispy, crunchy ear. And then we put them with a little salad of blood orange and radicchio treviso. So they're quite exciting, but they're totally delicious. And once you can persuade someone to try them, they'll be absolutely sold.
Yes, I have had them myself, actually, quite recently, and they are very tasty.
Yeah, yeah, I'm really into those. We've got a lovely, I splashed out on a truffle from Périgord this week, so we're having that on toast with salt pollock, which we salted ourselves and we cook with cream and a bit of truffle and potatoes and then shave fresh truffle over the top. So very excited about that.
How much does a whole truffle cost?
Well, at the moment the Périgord truffles are £1,000 a kilo. So I bought 50 grams, so there's £50 of truffle in this building, which for me as a house, you know, someone who's always very conscious of their costs, was a heart-stopping moment. It will be worth it. It will be worth it for sure. And then we've got the last of the game now in a pie with juniper, some ox tongue with a lovely sort of southwest French layered up potatoes and bacon, wrapped in bacon, so that will be nice. And then with the beautiful Yorkshire pink rhubarb, we're having some grilled herring.
Yes, I saw the rhubarb in the kitchen and
it is stunning. I absolutely love it. And I love to do it with an oily fish. I think it's such a nice combination. Yeah. We've got the pink grapefruits. All the citrus is so good at the moment because it's all new season. So we've got some lovely pink grapefruits and we've made a curd to put in a little tart. chocolate and stout cake, which I've done before here, and is a real star. We just have it slightly warm with a bit of cream, and that is a really nice one. We've got really into doing a lot of ice creams and sorbets here. My sous chef Dan is a very keen ice cream maker, so we always have a nice lot. We've got rhubarb ripple at the moment, lots of rhubarb.
And everything's made here, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, absolutely everything.
There was something on the menu recently which caught my eye, because it seemed to be such an unlikely combination, and that was celeriac and Lancashire Eccles cake. So what did you get? Did you actually get an Eccles cake?
Indeed, indeed. It sort of came to me because one of my very favourite restaurants in London is St John, and one of the things I love to have for my pudding is an Eccles cake, and it always comes with a lump of Lancashire cheese. So I thought, well, I love to do a bit of pastry for a vegetarian option. Let's see if we can somehow make the Lancashire be inside the Eccles cake and make it savoury. So celeriac I thought would be a nice foil. It's nice and robust. So we sautéed that with some onions and added allspice, which is the classic flavouring in Eccles cakes, a few currants and some grated Lancashire, and try to recreate that filling, really, but obviously a lot less sweet, and then put it inside really lovely buttery puff pastry, and did exactly as you would in Eccles, really. And it worked really well, I have to say. I have tried it before, just the shape, and not gone for the spice and things, but actually the spice really worked well.
You're enjoying St John's. I think you can probably discern that from some of your menus, actually. The duck hearts a little while ago,
yes,
for example, seems to have quite St John's-ish.
That was my Valentine's reference, the duck hearts, because that was for Valentine's. But certainly, I mean, I'm a great believer in using inside and out of the beast, which Fergus does wonderfully. I've worked with his wife, so I've had experience of those menus to work with, so I guess they have really influenced me. But I like a bit more Mediterranean. I'm a bit more Mediterranean than Fergus. Bring the sun in the winter a bit.
How much time do you spend actually sort of experimenting to think, to see whether things work or not? Is that a...
Yeah, I am a bit of seat of the pants type of a person, so I spend a day where I think about what will be on the menu next for the following week, and I talk to my sous chef, and we bounce ideas about, and I often ask him about the practicality of some things, and then mostly we do them on the day, which so far so good, really. But I think that's good, because I think that challenges my staff and keeps them sort of interested, and, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit hairy, but I think it's a great way to be honest.
Have you got any thoughts for next week's?
Oh, let me have a think. I haven't. I'm quite keen to do some veal shin. If the weather's still cool, I think I'll braise some veal shin, because the game is over now. So I always try to have one thing that's quite approachable, which I'm hoping this week is the guinea fowl on the menu. But I'll have to. I haven't sort of thought. I've only got one more week of monk's beard, so I think we'll certainly be having the monk's beard on again.
Right, and for the benefit of those who don't know what monk's beard is.
Monk's beard is it's a grass, really. It's in the chicory family. It grows in Tuscany, grows like a grass in tufts, but it's quite succulent. So people often think that it's in the samphire family, but it's not at all. It doesn't grow in marshes. It grows, you know...
So it doesn't have the saltiness that samphire
but it
has.
It does go really nicely with fish. I will often put it on with fish. But it's delicious. It's really nice.
I mean, you say it's from Tuscany. From Tuscany originally, or is your source
My source
Tuscany?
Is... I think that's the only place they grow it, to be perfectly honest. Right. And it does only have a 5-week season, and that is will soon be finished. Mm. And as I said before, all the citrus are just beautiful at the moment, but that won't go on for that much longer. Mm. But we're hopefully seeing a bit more sun now, because it's been roots and brassicas, and I'm hoping we'll move a bit away from them a bit. We've started with the sprouting broccoli, and then we all just keep our fingers crossed for the arrival of asparagus when we all... I'm delighted.
Yes. Yeah. So, Rosie, it sounds to me like you're having a good time here. What brought you to Fitzbillies in the first place?
Well, funnily enough, I grew up not far away from Cambridge, and I'd spent a lot of time here, and I decided to come back to this area, and had a project that I was working on here, which sadly didn't quite work out. And so at that time, I knew Tim and Alison had come up here. I'd known Tim and Alison for many years. We'd met through a place I worked in London that Alison also supplied, and Tim came to a lot. And Tim had said to me, look, do you have any ideas? Could you help us find a chef? And jokingly said, you do realise you're our ideal chef. So when my project fell through, it was seemed like serendipity, really, because it was literally at the time that they were trying to find someone. So I happily came on board, which was absolutely great. And I do love it here because Tim and Alison really let me do my thing, and they really believe in me, and that's great. It's rare. Yeah.
But you've also written, haven't you? I mean, there's you're in the Guardian cook supplement now on Saturdays, and you've written really quite a weighty book called The Kitchen Revolution.
Yes.
Now, that's actually an enormous book, isn't it? It's getting on for 600 pages.
Yeah. It's supposedly a recipe for almost every day of the year. So it's 48 weeks of recipes for a recipe every day of the week. So, and the idea is that it's a system to help people have food in their lives and not have it as a sort of, not a dominant thing that they find tiresome, but a joy and a pleasure and something that's easy and just part of your life. So it's all about good housekeeping and having a well-stocked store cupboard and all that kind of thing.
So it sort of gives advice as well as recipes.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it is seasonal, tries to be seasonal as well. Mm.
How long would a book like that take to write? Or was it on and off over a period of time and you can't really add it up?
I wrote it with two other people.
Yes.
So one of those was, she had no idea about cooking really, and so it was for her that we wrote it. So she tested all the recipes. So we did do it really over a year. So the other recipe writer and I would spend a week a month doing, a day a month doing kind of ideas, and then we'd go away and write 15 recipes each and give them to the tester. So it took a year. And we did, and then all our friends were great, and we farmed out all the recipes for a second test to other people. It was quite, there were times, because it was seasonal, it's the same as this time of year, you know, it's all about cabbages and roots, where we'd be sitting there going, not Swedes again, or not cabbages again, trying to think of things to inspire people. So it was a long process, but really worthwhile, really worthwhile.
Yeah, but there's a lot of competition, isn't there, as far as cookbooks is concerned?
Yeah, and I think the thing about The Kitchen Revolution is it's almost like a textbook, you know, it's like a science book or something. It doesn't have pictures, it's not very kind of approachable in a way, which is a shame, but it's the only way it could be because it's so enormous. But yes, I think a lot is about how they look, and that's what sells. And I think a lot of, you know, selling books is to do with how well you're known as well. But the competition is huge. I'd love to write another book, but I'm really enjoying the column that I write in Cook, because, you know, that's collecting up recipes, and that I'm given an ingredient every week, and then I have to think of something to do with that ingredient. And that for me, that's a really nice way to work. It's very similar to how I do the menu. So it's good. It's good.
Yes. It encourages creativity, doesn't it? When you've got to use this item.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's great, Rosie. Thanks very much.
Oh, that's a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Rosie Sykes, head chef at Fitzbillies in Trumpington Street. Rosie's book, The Kitchen Revolution, is published by Ebury Press, and it's still available. And you can find her column in The Guardian's Saturday food supplement, Cook.
And after that interview, I'm thinking I need to go and have another evening meal at Fitzbillies. It's open for dinner on Thursday, Friday and Saturday nights. Good grown-up food, I would say. And while we're on the subject of cookbooks, we've been recommended a digital cookbook
produced by Alex Yandel, formerly a student at Hills Road Sixth Form College. Now, I've had a look of it, and it is of startlingly good quality. And someone was telling me yesterday of how well the recipe she tried from it worked. If you're interested, it's called Cook, Taste, Smile, and is available for iPad and iPhone from the iBookstore and App Store, respectively. It has won the Digital Cookbook of the Year award from About.com too, so you needn't take my word for it.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Coming up, Matt gets clueless in the kitchen, Tom Lewis on sherry, and our review of the best food and drink in today's newspapers.
And you can keep up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where you will read about the news we discover ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources.
Now, more than 1 in 100 of us have an intolerance to gluten and suffer from celiac disease. It can be a serious health issue. But what do you do if you're a sufferer? Well, some food stores, such as Urban Larder, carry a wide range of gluten-free products. Or you can go to a relatively new stall on the market. It's called Gluten Tooten, and I went along to talk with Maria, who runs the stall, to find out more. Maria, you run the gluten-free stall at the market. What sort of foods do you do?
We have various things to choose from. Today we have sausage rolls, cornbread, chicken chimichanga, which is a Mexican dish.
So is that a hot one?
Quite spicy, right. Yes. and there's also Spanish tortilla, which is like omelette equivalent with chorizo sausage. And we have pizza pie, pistachio and dark chocolate shortbread, wow. Pecan pies, and also we can do an Aberdeen Angus burger to order, and toasted sandwiches.
How do you get round the gluten problem? What do you use instead of normal wheat flour?
It's a mixture between rice flour and corn flour, or our maize flour.
Right, so they don't have any gluten in them then?
No.
When you say it's a mixture, have you experimented with different types of...
We have, but also you can buy it as a mix as well.
And you find that works the best?
That does work quite well, yeah.
Yeah. Is there any difference in, because I know that you're not celiac yourself, but is there any difference in the flavour if you make it with sort of gluten-free flour as opposed to wheat flour?
I think there probably is a difference, and also it's the texture as well, you know, sort of with pastry particularly, because it doesn't have gluten in it, it doesn't sort of stay together so well, but we've managed to sort of... do a pastry for the sausage rolls that's working quite well, and the pizza pies.
Right, yeah. I can see there is some experimentation that has to go on to get it right.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
And obviously, therefore, you do a mixture of sweet and savoury dishes as well. What if somebody had a request, like a birthday coming up? Would you do a cake for somebody?
Yeah, we can definitely do birthday cakes. At Christmas time, a guy wanted a panettone. So we did a sample for him, and he really liked it, so that was good.
Oh, yes.
Any particular orders or special requests is fine. You know, we'll try anything for them.
And how long has the stall been here?
Since October.
Right,
so about 4 months.
So you've suffered the winter period then?
We have, yes. We've been out here in the snow and the frost.
And the wind as well.
The wind is cold, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're looking forward to being here in the summer now as your reward.
Yes, we'll see how the summer goes.
And what days are you in the market?
We're Monday, Tuesday and Saturday.
But you're not always in the same place, I think.
No, that's right. Generally, Monday I have a spot on the outside opposite Mark's now, of next Monday. On the first row.
Right, in the expensive row.
On the outside. It's a little bit more per day, but hopefully it'll be worth it and obviously catch people's eye. And then otherwise we're on row C.
So that's the third row in.
The second aisle, third row. Tuesdays we're at the Guildhall end and Saturday at the French Connection end.
What's it like for celiac sufferers in cafes and restaurants in Cambridge? Are they well catered for, do you think?
I think it's getting better. It's my son that has celiac disease.
Right.
He was diagnosed about 5 years ago. Things have improved. But I think also some of the staff in the restaurants need a bit of training. We were in one place that did offer gluten-free pasta, but they brought along breadsticks and also put a wafer in his ice cream. So they're getting there, but it's a bit of a long process, I think, for people to be, you know, better aware.
To find out more about Gluten Tooten, you can visit their Facebook page, featuring some very nice photographs of their food. And in case you're wondering, Tooten is spelt T-U-T-E-N. There's also a Cambridgeshire celiac website that gives information about restaurants which cater for celiacs, as well as producing newsletters and recipes.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Coming up, Tom Lewis on Sherry and our review of the best food and drink ideas in today's papers.
Time for Clueless in the Kitchen now, as Matt gets to grips with a Celtic classic.
The word serendipity comes from a fairy tale in the 1700s called The Three Princes of Serendip, where the heroes were always making accidental discoveries. The other weekend, I was watching Billy Connolly being interviewed by Newsnight's Kirsty Walk, and at the time I was wondering what I could make, what was new to me. And watching these two Scots, scones became the obvious choice. So I checked out a couple of books, and then I went online, and by way of accidental discovery, sorry, serendipity, there was a recipe for scones made by Kirsty Walk. Cheese, chive and mustard scones, which she had made for the great Comic Relief Bake Off programme. Don't think I've ever had savoury scones before. So I'm in the kitchen now, and this recipe will require the following ingredients to make roughly 18 scones. So I will need 500 grams of plain flour, plus extra for flouring, generous pinch of salt, some baking powder. The right proportion of raising agent is important here, as otherwise the bread will be flat and go hard if there isn't enough baking powder, but too much would cause it to rise quickly and then collapse. 1 teaspoon of English mustard powder, some unsalted butter, strong cheddar, very nice strong mature cheddar, some fresh snipped chives. I don't have any chives, so I'm going to go for finely chopped red onion. And another alternative to chives would be something like the green parts of a spring onion, or maybe a bit of leek. Just something that adds freshness. Then I'll have 300 mils of milk, a free-range egg beaten with a little milk for glazing, and finally some apples to kind of serve and make the bread look nice, or the scone look nice. You know, actually, this should make 18 scones, but I think I'm just going to make one big one, because I saw Nigel Slater try this, and when he described it as one great big mound of cheesiness where you just simply tear off what you want, I don't think I can resist having a go at that. So let's get going. With the preparation method, firstly I must preheat my oven, take everything out, to 220 degrees, as the dough must be baked immediately after mixing and shaping. Now, this is my first time making this, as it is with every recipe I choose to do on Clueless in the Kitchen, so I want to make sure I get it right first time. Now, with scones, the outside should not be dry, hard, or pale, and even if I'm doing a big scone, the same should apply. They should be light, flaky, and golden brown, and to achieve this, I think it needs to be baked in a moderately hot oven so that the dough sets quickly. Scones originated in Scotland, or maybe Wales or England. An early Scottish recipe had them made from oats, where they were rolled into a large loaf, much like I'm going to do here, and then cut into wedges and cooked over an open fire. And in Wales, these small round yeast cakes, I think they were called, would be cooked on bake stones or griddles. Today, there's dozens of varieties of scones. There's buttermilk scone recipes, chocolate scones, and scones filled with chocolate chunks, treacle scones with cinnamon, nutmeg, brown sugar and treacle, and they get glazed and frosted scones, and like my attempt here, savoury variations like cheddar dill and parmesan garlic scones. So with mixing bowl at the ready, I now begin to pour in my flour. All of this will be sifted through, of course. A generous pinch of salt. Generous. Honestly, that's not quite as much as it sounded. Some mustard powder, and vitally, 2 1/4 teaspoons of baking powder. Now I'm going to give this mixture a second sieving, because I've got to make sure that the baking powder is evenly distributed throughout the mix to prevent from irregular rising. Next, I take 65 grams of unsalted butter, which I'm cutting into little blocks, and I'm going to rub these blocks into the mixture until it resembles fine breadcrumbs. Now I'm going to have buttery hands with which to operate our expensive recording equipment. Hope the technical director isn't listening to this. Now I am using the very finest part of my cheese grater to grate half of my cheese, and then I'm going to roughly chop up the other half, and then I'm going to stir that into the flour mixture. Oh, and of course add my chopped red onion with a little bit of parsley. For the origin of the word scone or scone, some say it comes from the Dutch word schoenbrot, I hope I've pronounced that right, and that means beautiful bread, whilst others argue that it comes from the Stone of Destiny, where the kings of Scotland were crowned. Look at all this lovely chunky cheese, just waiting to clog up my arteries. And with everything neatly arranged around me, I now add my very finely grated cheese into the mix. The main mix containing, of course, the flour, baking powder, mustard powder, and salt. In goes the onion. And finally, all the chunky little blocks of cheese I've added. Almost 400 grams of cheese. And now I stir the whole thing together. Now ahead of glazing, I get a quick egg. Open up. Drop in. And quickly whisk that up with a little milk. Lovely. Now I measure out 300 mils of milk. I may not need to use all of it. Still just enough for some tea. Phew. When I add this milk, it's going to activate the baking powder, so I'm going to need to work quickly from here on in. And working quickly is not my strong suit. And stir. Keep mixing. Sounds like Strictly Come Dancing, doesn't it? Keep mixing. Now it's starting to feel a little bit more like concrete, and there's still plenty of dry, floury bits in this mix that haven't even touched the milk yet. Phew! It's a good thing I'm so physically strong and modest. Phew! Gooey isn't the word for this. Come on. Now I'm going to turn this dough out onto a floured surface, and I'm going to knead it lightly into a manageable ball. Say 6 to 8 times worth of kneading should be enough. Any more kneading could cause the bread to be too tough. Knead. 4. 5. Flour back in the middle. 6. 7. 8. And 1 for luck. Whew, there we go. 1 big ball of kneaded dough. Quite happy with that. Now I transfer this to my pre-floured up baking tray. The oven is getting nice and hot. Now I'm going to press down on top of the ball with my fist to flatten it slightly. Now I take my milk glaze, and I give the whole thing a nice brush. Now I'm going to take a knife, and I'm going to score a deep cross into the dough, which will allow it to hopefully then break into individual pieces after it's cooked. Now I'm quickly just going to grate a little bit more cheese over the top. And now I transfer to the oven, where it will bake for around about 30 minutes, or, well, until the cheese topping looks a lovely gold and brown and crisp. It's important to get the dough in the oven quick before the activity of the baking powder subsides, so I hope I've achieved that. And now, 30 minutes later, the moment of truth. I turn off my oven and see how it looks. Oh, wow. Lovely and golden. And it has risen. The smell is quite intense. Mixture of dough and cheese, as you would expect. And the scoring has nicely split up the loaf, I suppose you could say, as much as it is a scone. And it looks all very nice and lovely and melted, and the cheese has gone a lovely golden glazed brown along the top. Now that is half the battle. It looks nice, it has risen, but have I got the consistency correct? Okay, an additional 25 minutes later, because there simply wasn't enough time for the bread to rise properly. It was still quite gooey in the middle. So I've given it an extra cook, and it's come out. I'm just going to try a little bit now. Mmm, yeah. I see what they mean now by adding those large chunks of cheese in there, because they just come out like little parcels, little packages, dotted all throughout the loaf. It's very nice. Incredibly fattening, I'm sure. Why wouldn't it be tasty when it's got this much cheese in it? But the apple, the russet apple, and the mango chutney just really sets it off. It's so lovely. Overall, though, I think this is quite a tricky dish to make. I'm not sure whether I'd bother doing it again, simply because I don't know that many people would want to touch it knowing the amount of cheese that's in there. Overall, I think it's not exactly what I'd call successful, but it was fun to do, it was interesting to do, and I'm happy with what I've got. So you're listening to Clueless in the Kitchen, on Flavour, on Cambridge 105. Mango chutney has saved me so many times it should receive an award for bravery. Still, there is a serious element to Clueless that we'd like to introduce, and that is eating well and saving money. Now, I costed up today's scone recipe, and with all ingredients accounted for, a half dozen scones would have cost £1.32, and that is for 6 homemade, very tasty cheese and chive savoury scones. That's not bad value compared to the shops, is it? And if you have the time, you gain the confidence, and you'll be able to produce something of a quality that will easily surpass a store-bought equivalent. In future episodes, I'll be investigating and creating meals where the cost gap between homemade and processed will be much more significant, where it will truly pay to not be clueless in the kitchen. Now, the Festival of Food and Drink Eat Cambridge is fast approaching. You may have seen the programme in some of Cambridge's independent food and drink shops in the last few days. Some events are already sold out, and you can get details via Twitter if you follow @EatCambridge. But here's the position as it was yesterday lunchtime. Pavitt's Pie and Mash Supper, the Cambridge Cookery School Supper Club, and the Clandestine Gourmet, to name a few, are already sold out. But there is still time to book for lots of other things. For example, a tasting at Inda's Kitchen, or you could reserve a place at the Loaf for Life Sourdough Workshop, or join the Food Safari, so do get booking.
In our newspaper review 2 weeks ago, we quoted Hugh Friendly Whittingstall's concern with the way most ducks are reared. It is difficult to get free-range ducks from supermarkets. However, there is a stall on the Sunday Market in Cambridge, which sells free-range ducks, as well as their eggs. They also sell chicken and venison. It's a really good stall, so if you are after good quality, well-kept duck, that's the place to go. It's the Hawthorne Farm stall, and is to be found just to the left of the Earth's Crust bread stand.
And also on the last programme, we had a feature on the Cambridge Brewhouse, the new pub and eating place in Cambridge. This week, we're pleased to hear that its brewing equipment is being connected up and they'll be brewing soon.
You were talking with Tom Lewis last time about sherry, Alan, and I know you were going to continue that conversation.
Yeah, it is a surprisingly interesting subject and one I think I'm going to pay a lot more attention to. Let's first recap a little on what Tom said last time. He talked about the fact that, like with table wines, it's the grape varieties, the soil type, and the aging and blending that gives us the different types of sherry. The basic style is pale, either Fino or Manzanilla, and both are good as an aperitif, especially on a hot day. And they go well with tapas-style food, olives, jamón ibérico, bread with oil. The darker sherries are more complex, such as Amontillado, Oloroso or Palo Cortado. Tom explains why this is the time to be buying sherry.
Quality is good and prices are low. You can get bottles of 30-year-old sherries properly aged for around £20. You can't do that with other wines.
And in case you're wondering about where to find out about food matches, Tom had this to say about the subject.
I found a book with some recommendations from Heston Blumenthal on matching food to different types of sherry. He suggests the following. Sardines with a Manzanilla, walnuts with Fino, pecorino cheese with Amontillado, foie gras with Oloroso, roasted hazelnuts with Palo Cortado. He also suggests hock of ham to match with a cream sherry, and bitter chocolate with Pedro Ximenez.
I think in Britain we're generally most familiar with sweet sherries, so I asked Tom about them.
This is my favourite part. Sweet sherries are made from a grape called Pedro Ximenez, PX. 100% PX sherries have the colour and consistency of used engine oil, but they're utterly delicious. Imagine a rich, fruited, nutty spice Christmas pudding in a glass. That's a PX. And the amazing thing is, they still have good acidity, so they don't become flabby or cloying. They're still fresh. 100% PX needs to match to a rich, sticky dessert like Christmas pudding or treacle tart. Or you can pour it over homemade vanilla ice cream. Two glasses. One to pour over, and one to drink with it.
That does sound very rich and indulgent. There are less sweet sherries, are there?
Yes, PX can be blended with Oloroso or Amontillado to give something less intensely sweet, but with all the character and flavour. These are the cream sherries that we associate with aunts and vicars and so on of yore.
And what would you match these with?
Well, they can be a dessert in their own right, just a small glass after a meal. You could match the roasted nutty flavours to a pecan tart, and a sweet Oloroso will match well with blue cheese like Stilton. I would serve these pretty much at room temperature, maybe a degree or two colder. Waitrose have a good one to look out for. It's their own label, and again it's made by Lustau. It's called the Waitrose Herrizana Rich Cream.
We talked earlier about the list of sherry bars. Is there anywhere in Cambridge to go out and drink good sherry?
Sadly, we don't have anywhere that specialises in sherry in Cambridge that I'm aware of, but I think it's only a matter of time. The punter on Pound Hill has held a couple of sherry dinners, and Hotel Duvan does a number of very good sherries by the glass. But to experience a real sherry bodega without having to fly to Andalusia, you just need to pop down to London, which a lot of Cambridge people do every day. I'm one of them. And just next door to King's Cross Station is Bar Pepito, which was Britain's first dedicated sherry bar. If you imagine an authentic little bodega being lifted up and transplanted from Spain, then that's Pepito's. It has jamón ibérico carved off the bone to order, and does plates of meat and cheese with a range of sherries. What I especially like about it is that the sherry list is very good indeed, but it's not unnecessarily long. There's not more than a dozen, but all of them are well chosen. So they're good, they cover all the styles, but the list doesn't become confusing and endless. There's also the opportunity to try sherry in flights. You get three smallish servings of different sherries to compare and contrast. And there are occasional specials. Right now they have the Las Palmas range, which are fabulous old finos from Gonzales Bias, made without filtration. They also serve cooked food and table wines if you want to make a meal of it. But for me, it's just a great place to meet friends after work on the way home.
Well, that certainly got me interested in trying more sherries. Where's a good place to start?
I think the entry-level versions of the paler styles is the best place. Tio Pepe would be your ideal first sherry. And although it involves a trip to London, visiting a sherry bar is a really good way to try it out if you're unsure of things like serving temperatures and food matches. From there, you can move on to the older, darker, more expensive sherries. And don't forget the sweet ones as well.
And that was Tom Lewis. And I think I can safely predict that at the end of my next trip to London, I'll be in the sherry bar he mentioned. Don't forget, you can find out more by looking at Tom's blog, which is the Cambridge Wine Blogger. Now let's have a look at some of the food and drink ideas in today's papers. And because time is racing past, we'll concentrate just on the Financial Times and the Guardian today. A quick whiz through first. Janice Robinson in the Financial Times discusses Spanish white wine, and specifically that made from the Gordeaux grape. Not the best known, but it reminds us that the limits of exploration in food and wine, including sherries, seem infinite and a constant source of interest and pleasure. The Financial Times magazine this week focuses on Brazil, and so there's also a recommendation of some Brazilian wine, something I've never drunk. Peruvian, Bolivian, Argentinian and Chilean, yes. Brazil, no. Tim Hayward's piece today is, as usual, very well written and very amusing. And it reminds me that it will be very good to see him at the bloggers event in Eat Cambridge on the 17th of March, something I'll definitely be going to. It's well worth reading, and it shows that even the delights of good food are as prone as international rugby is in its ability to inspire high emotion. Rowley Lee in the Financial Times has a recipe for a Tuscan treat, pasta e ceci, a soup based on chickpeas, but with a fair bit of chilli in it too. There's a very interesting piece on Brazilian ingredients. So if you're suffering from a jaded palate, how about exploring ingredients like the baru nut, the grumihama fruit, or a mandiaca, a type of cassava?
Are there any Brazilian recipes?
Well, there aren't, no, but there are some example of Brazilian dishes with some nice pictures, such as peach palm tagliatelle, millefeuille of beet and anchovy, or the quite beautiful-looking nest of aracacha with pichori herbs.
But with access to international recipes via the internet, this is something we could make at home, assuming that we can find the ingredients, yes?
Yes, so maybe one of us should and report back. Okay, clueless in the kitchen.
There's a challenge.
On to the Guardian, and the first thing I looked for was Rosie Sykes' recipe, and you can find it in the Cook supplement. It's for coconut and parsnip cake, and it accompanies an article on coconut oil, which you can buy in Asian and Chinese supermarkets. It's solid at room temperature, by the way. We'll return to Cook later if we've got time. In The Guardian magazine, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall focuses on plantain with three recipes. Yotam Ottolenghi begins his piece by describing his acute embarrassment when recently filming in Africa, and it's left him with a stinging sense of abject failure. It was to do with not being able to cook a very popular local food. But he presents a recipe today, along with a photo to document his newfound success. It's merguez, a spicy lamb, mutton or beef sausage. He also gives a bubble and squeak recipe based on them.
Are there any wine recommendations?
Yeah, Monday's the beginning of Fairtrade Fortnight, and Fiona Beckett provides a useful review of Fairtrade wines, describing one, a Shiraz at $4.99, as being of fantastic value. I think that's all we've got time for. So we'll say our goodbyes in a minute. Don't forget, though, at 3 to 5 o'clock today, Saturday Sports Zone with Chris and Brian.
Yep, that's all from Flavour today. So many thanks to all of our interviewees. Adam Byrne of the First Rule Supper Club, George of the Rockers Steakhouse on Mill Road, Rosie Sykes, head chef of Fitzbillies, Maria from the Gluten Tootenstool at Cambridge Market, and wine critic Tom Lewis.
And don't forget, you can follow Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105. That's where you will read about the news that we discover, and we retweet other food and drink stories from Cambridge sources. The next live edition will be Sunday the 9th of March at 12, and you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website. So be sure to join us next time. Coming up next, Saturday Lunch.
Goodbye.